I'm Mark Lund, Luther College. I'm an economist. And the session today will be on the response of the church. If I could have taken more room on the bulletin board, I would have probably given you this title, Responsible Christian Lifestyles Given Global Economic Realities. Because during this week, we've been talking about some economic problems. It's been at the global level. And I want to look now at responsible Christian action based on those realities. During this session, I fear that I will be speaking most of the time. And it's because there are a number of things that I would like to say. And so if I say something that creates any problems for you and you want to jump in and say something, by all means do that. But for the most part, I will be presenting some of my views. They will be based on some of the things we've discussed during the first 3 days, and they'll also be based on some thinking that I've done over several years as to what is the appropriate response. To begin with, I want to quote Robert Bella, who's in the sociology of religion, I believe at Berkeley. He says, the major problem we face today is how do we live responsibly in a revolutionary world? And the world is indeed quite revolutionary, whether we are aware of that or not. He goes on to say, how can we live together in a just world community? What happens in Christ that helps us live in community? Well, I want to talk a little bit about the church today. As I understand it, and not being a historian, the early Christian church was a sect of outcasts, the oppressed, and the poor. Sects usually result when a major religion or denomination discriminates, or maybe I should just say does not minister to the poor or the oppressed. And so a sect is created. It tries to create a more humane society, and most sects stress some of the same things like solidarity, equality, mutual aid, sympathy, trust, etc. Well, today, the denominations which we belong to seem to depend very heavily on the social economic class and our race. We are the status quo. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Most of us belong to churches that are the status quo. We have the power. And whether we like it or not, to many people, we are the enemy. Whether they point to the church or not, we are the status quo and we're seen as the enemy. Now, the people in the sociology of religion say a tragic thing is that often the religion is a reflection of the culture more than it's a reflection of the teachings of Christ. And so I'm saying that what we need is a vision, some kind of a dream of a better society. Some people would define religion as a vision of life. I think that is a tough task. And so the things we're going to deal with today, or the things I want to discuss today, are not easy things to talk about. The task is tough. I think some of them certainly border on the radical. The reason why it's so tough for us to dream is that we have this problem. How can we as Christians who were originally a sect of the poor, but through history became very powerful and the status quo, how can we dream the dreams of freedom, liberation, justice, and equity for all people? It's a tough challenge. The early church may have thought about that a great deal, but we are, because of our culture, we are members of the status quo. We're greatly influenced by our culture, our religion. How can we then dream that dream of freedom, liberation, justice, and equity for all? One thing appears to be clear to me, and we could debate on this issue, but we are not poor. We cannot imitate the poor. We would only pretend. And I think that's dangerous for us to say, well, we're going to be the poor. We're going to try and figure out what it really means. I mean, certainly we need to listen. But we're not going to march down to El Salvador and fight the wars. They know their problems. They know what needs to be done. We are the rich. And I think that's important for us to realize that when we try to look at these problems. There's no need trying to fool ourselves that we're going to become the poor again and understand the problems that way. So then the questions become, what can we do as a church, as responsible Christians? I think the first thing would be that we must find out what is going on. The first few sessions we've talked about the new international economic order. We've talked about trade between rich countries and poor countries. We've talked about the linkage between the rich countries and the poor countries, this concept of dependency. Well, there are two views that I've been talking about during the last few days. One view is that the poor are the problem. I mean, they're poor, and that's where the problem is. And we who are rich in the north can solve that problem. We have the answers. And so they lack this, and we've talked about that in the hunger problem or in the development problem, and we in the north will find the solutions and help them. Another one is maybe we, the rich, are a big part of the problem. And we need to understand what is going on and be very open when we examine the problems and listen to the South. Now, it's interesting, when we were in Peru, a lot of the students would be asking the people wherever we were, what are the problems down here? And when we were in the mountains, far removed from the city life in the modern world, the poor people would say, the problem is the rich. The systems, the structures, we're so powerless. We can't do much. We would move down into Lima, the capital city, and we would ask the same people, or we would ask the people the same question, what are the problems? And they'd say, the problems are the poor. We have an Indian problem. Too many uneducated. They're just creating all kinds of problems for us. They're moving into the city. Well, depends on where you're sitting, who you talk to, how you view that problem. I want to just summarize a couple things from yesterday because we said it's important to find out what is going on. One of the reports that came out in 1980 was a report of the Presidential Commission on World Hunger. And they had, the commission was very divided. A very difficult time coming up with any kind of a report. And in fact, if you want to read the report, probably the most interesting thing to do is to read the dissenting voices that are put in the appendix in the back, because then you see some sharp differences in points of view. I want to just summarize a couple points from yesterday. The cause of hunger and the cause of hunger is poverty. And why do we have poverty? This point of view is that it's related to the cultural, economic, and political conditions which prevent the poor from growing and storing their own food or having the income to buy it. Although poverty is the cause of hunger, poverty itself results from inadequate and inequitable access to income-producing assets, the lack of power to decide how the assets are used and distributed. The problem, it was the right-hand side. It's a social, that we talked about yesterday, the social-political problem. But they go on to say that there is technology that exists to improve the productivity of the poor. They have the capacity to use it. Oh, there's a story I forgot to tell yesterday that's just a gem. A Harvard research team, it's Harvard. You don't often think of Harvard as being a strong school in the area of agriculture, but they have a good development institute and a lot of agricultural economists, et cetera, who are there. And the Harvard team went down about 15 years ago to show the peasants how to increase their efficiency. Because, you know, our impression that they just don't know, they lack understanding, they're not very intelligent, they're not capable of producing like we are. That Harvard team worked for, I forget how many years, and it never came close to matching the yields of the people there. And they were working with the same resources. I mean, you couldn't bring anything in from the outside, but they were going to show them with all of their knowledge how to do it. They didn't even come close. So, I mean, it isn't that they don't have the inability to learn and do it. It's basically getting access to the resources. It becomes a political problem that keeps the technology out of the hands of the poor. Well, that was one of the dissenting voices. And it would go on to say that self-reliance is very important. It would go on to say that We need to redistribute resources to a certain extent to give the poor a chance to produce. Under trade, we talked about trade earlier, they say the main issue is fair trade, not free trade. A trade where both sides can benefit, not where most of the benefits tend to go to those who already have the power, and thus creating more inequality. Well, we've talked a little bit about those problems. That's what I mean by trying to understand what is going on. One way of understanding, too, is to listen to the Third World. Archbishop Romero, who was a very conservative Catholic priest, who was there to teach the vertical relationship between God and people, all of a sudden, after so many years, finally said, you've got to look at this horizontal relationship, how people relate to people. And what he saw, he could not believe. And here a very conservative person got pulled into this whole debate on poverty and justice. And finally he got to the point where when he would receive money, instead of repairing the broken windows, because it was an embarrassment to the Catholic Church, pigeons would fly in, etc., he started spending that money on the poor. And it caused a lot of problems for him. And eventually, it's about a year ago and a couple months, he was shot, I believe, administering communion.
Is that the one that was shot administering communion?
Yeah, right. And so there are a lot of people who are speaking out. And we need to listen if we're going to be able to understand. We brought in some people who've been thrown out of countries, a priest who've been thrown out of Korea, etc., to Luther College to let them speak and tell a story. I think we have to be open to that story. A second thing we need to do is find out where we fit into this scheme. With what is the economic, the social structures? By the way, they're really hard to understand and get a handle on. It isn't an easy task by any means. They're big, complex problems. We need to work at that. You know, who are we in the North? What role do we play in this? And then we can say, what do we do? There's another, a little different way of looking at this. I can't remember who is the author of these three questions, but it says there are three basic questions that all people should ask. The first one is, what can I know? And so that's much like, what is going on? What can I know? The second one is, what ought I to do? And now we moved into some ethical questions, and I want to pick up on that quite a bit a little later. The third one we need to do, and this is the one that the author, I think it was Kant who said this, but the author it says that we really fail in this area, and that is, we should ask the question, what may I hope for? We seldom ask that, but we need to dream. We need a vision, and we don't spend much time, I don't think, doing that. There's a real nice graph in the book called Limits to Growth. On the vertical axis, they put time. On the horizontal axis, they put area, geographical area. And they say, where do we spend most of our time when we're thinking, making decisions, whatever? We spend it in here. We're asking questions like, I wonder what we're going to have for dinner today, or where should I hike tomorrow? But it has to do with whole and village area and what we're going to do in the next few days. Those kinds of decisions just monopolize our time. What we need to do when we talk about hope and a theology of hope and some vision is get out into this area a little bit. What's going to happen down the road so many years? What about future generations? And when you look at the area, rather than concentrating on Holden Village or your home, or in my case, Decorah or Luther, start thinking about the United States. Start thinking about the globe, the whole world. That's what I think a theology of hope and vision spends time looking in that area, and we don't do that very much. If we're responsible Christians, I think we need to spend more time out in this area rather than down in this area. What can we do then? I want to stress three areas in which I think we can do some work. The first one is there are works of mercy. By the way, I'm taking this information now from Jim McGinnis, and I'm finally going to really hit Jim McGinnis today. I'm really going to use him, because it is every time I read it, I find more things in there. I can't believe that person was able to put together so much economics, ideas of action, ideas of justice, and into a book like this that's so readable. But he talks about three areas in which we can work. First, works of mercy. Works of mercy is really charity, a handout, a gift. As I'll say later, I'm not very big on gifts and handouts. But there are clearly times when they're needed. We have refugee problems. We have problems of drought at times. And so that's one place in which we can act, look at the poor, the oppressed, the downtrodden. A second area is to support acts of justice. That's what I really want to dwell on this morning, and so we're going to get into a justice theme today. The third is lifestyle changes. Well, tomorrow what I'm going to do is look at some lifestyle changes as I see that. I realize that's a theme here at Holden, and maybe it's even risky having someone like myself talk about lifestyles and what's going on. I mean, I'm sort of dabbling in it, and yet I want to give you at least some of my impressions and feelings about it. But I also want to emphasize tomorrow the idea of justice, acts of justice. The difference between tomorrow and today, however, will be that tomorrow I'll focus on justice at home. Today I'm going to talk about global justice. Just in case any of you are curious to know what I will do tomorrow, is I think justice begins at home, and until you can figure out what's going on at home, you can never make the extension to the global level. And I'm going to start at the global level, and maybe that's a little dangerous. I'm all turned around, but after you get frustrated or discouraged, or you think, oh man, that's so far away, I can't comprehend what's going on, it doesn't seem terribly immediate and very relevant, then maybe I can come back and say a little bit about justice at home and get you started off on the right foot. Okay. We have some very helpful tools, I think, for looking at global justice. When I came here to Holden, I came here because as I found out yesterday in the session, I'm an introvert. I don't really like being in large groups. The reason why I teach at a school like I do is I love the interaction with students, one-on-one, a couple of students at a time. Oh, I just thrive on that. But one of the jobs is you have to teach and give some lectures, so I do that. But one of the reasons why I came here was just to meet people, talk to people, everybody, get ideas from all over. Right? It's just so much fun. And a couple of the sessions that I've sat in on have been very helpful. They haven't been so helpful in that they're brand new ideas. It's just that they've really reinforced some of the things that I was already thinking about. So I want to just summarize, or just briefly mention a couple of those, some tools for working with global justice. The first one was a presentation by Larry Rasmussen when he talked about the Greek term oikos, O-I-K-U-S, and said how it is the root word for economy, it is the root word for ecology, and it is the root word for ecumenical. And how we need, in all of our decision-making deliberations, to think about the important balance, the interrelatedness between taking care of our home, the earth, the economy, the natural environment, and then the importance of community. And so as I look at the global problems, that's an important thing for me, being in balance. Then John Schramm, in one of his Living Word Encounters, talked about, I believe this was yesterday, sufficiency. Pretty radical idea. As an economist, I've been toying with the idea of there's something way off on our definition of economics. It makes me uncomfortable. We say that economics, I talked about this last week, but we say economics is a discipline where we have unlimited wants, they're insatiable, human nature, and we have limited resources, that's nature. And so economist's job is to be an efficiency expert, to produce as many of those goods and services possible, limited resources, to meet those unlimited wants. But you always want more and more growth. And well, after reading Schumacher and others and talking to a lot of individuals, something seems wrong with that, at least to me. And so I think the definition of economics where we have limited wants. And my wife and I now actually make a list usually for the coming year of things that we think we need to add to our what we've already got, and you really can't find very many things you need to add. And so life really becomes one of maintaining what you have. But sufficiency is what John Schramm was talking about. Enough is enough. I'm going to read something here that didn't hit home until after I heard John Schramm's presentation yesterday. A little book that talks about the free enterprise system and a system that relies more on self-reliance. It says that democracy and the free enterprise system protect and encourage, first and foremost, the individual's formal freedom to get ahead and to acquire wealth. Boy, that hit me like a bomb last night. You know, what this society really does is protect the freedom to get ahead and acquire wealth. When we're talking about sufficiency, fitting in, enough is enough. I've also appreciated hearing the Easter message in a different light, where we say that that message is kind of scary, because what it means is Jesus is what Jesus had to say is true. That radical message, we have to take it seriously. And that's kind of scary. So thank goodness we had Pentecost and the reminder of the work of the Spirit to help us through this. I am summarizing what's been going on. I need to move on. You want to make a comment?
I was wondering, that Harvard study, did you say they went to Peru, was it?
No, I don't even recall where it was. But it was somewhere, I believe, in the Andes Mountains.
Well, I think that was good. They went down there using not taking anything in, and they found out they couldn't improve on the situation there. Did they invite some of the people then from that area to come up here and show us how they
I don't. I don't know the study well enough to tell you exactly how it worked and what the follow-up was. My guess is that certainly they didn't. That's a good point. Well, and then the term shalom. A friend of mine, Jerry Folk, I mentioned this. Did I mention that this week? So I don't want to repeat anything this week. But he has a little two-page article that's so good when he talks about shalom. He says there's five characteristics of shalom. One is wholeness, harmony, fitting in. I think that's so good. A second is that shalom originates in God, a God who liberated the oppressed, a God who seeks justice and mercy, and we should not forget that. Third, he said that shalom is very normative. That means what ought to be. It deals with the future. There's a vision, a dream, a transformation of this world. We'll be dealing with that. Fourth, it's an ethical challenge. We are to minister wherever we find oppression, poverty, discrimination, human suffering. Justice, then, is an indispensable part of the term shalom. And finally, Jesus and the cross are instrumental. Forgiveness in the salvation story. And the fact, too, that we may suffer as we speak for the poor. By the way, I didn't say this. There's earlier, but the poor, whether you're aware of it or not, are conveniently quiet. The poor seldom are heard on their own, and the poor seldom do anything that's very revolutionary on their own. It's only when the intellectuals or the people from the upper classes who have lost out or become disenchanted decide to try and mobilize the forces and get things going. That tends to be pretty true historically. So that's a real danger there, because the poor are so conveniently quiet. Okay. Well, I want to move now to some acts of justice. Jim McGinnis, in his book, builds his whole book around the concept of justice. And on page 10, he lists four components of justice. Very good components. Everything he does through the rest of the book is to tie back into this framework. He says that, at least he points to these four components of justice. I don't believe he says that they're all inclusive by any means, but he wants to stress these four. When we're talking about justice, the first thing we deal with is sufficient life goods. That really means basic needs: food, shelter, clothing, health care, and the right to work and education. Now, justice to me, I have no problem saying that that makes good sense, that people have rights to basic needs just because they are human beings here on this earth, which is so plentiful. His second component deals with dignity and self-worth. And this is, I've really been strengthened in my beliefs here too these last 10 days, because it says under dignity, we are to recognize and affirm and call forth the values, the uniqueness of each person and each people. Then he talks about participation. The right of individuals and people to shape their own destinies. It's a component of justice. And then solidarity. He says that's the corresponding duty to promote all of these rights above with and for others. Well, when you look at those components of justice and you look at our Christian heritage and tradition, what are some things that we can do? I want to list just a few ideas here, and then I'll go into a description of what's on the right-hand side. First.
Mark?
Yes?
Excuse me, before you leave that, shaping their own destiny, that's fine if you're talking about the poor, but what if you're talking about the wealthy? Because you just kind of knocked down that definition of economics, or said that you didn't like that definition, that the free enterprise system allows us to get to be wealthy. Isn't that protecting and creating your own destiny? I mean, it seems to me that that is not a justice definition or something that's included in justice. If you look at it, doesn't justice mean being more concerned about the other person than yourself, or equally as concerned? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're getting at. If someone wanted to comment on that and discuss it a little, or you want to rephrase it, please do so.
Not sure.
Well, Larry, you want to give
it? And this may be just rephrasing it. If you already begin with an imbalance of power, rich and poor, then to say we're free to shape our own destiny is to nod in the direction of the rich, because they're the ones that have the wherewithal. So as an abstract definition, it sounds okay, but in the actual playing out of the dynamics in society, that's a favoring of the rich over the poor.
Okay. Let me continue on then and see if this helps a little bit and then come back. When he talks about the problems of poverty or hunger, and he moves across horizontally under the participation point, he says that poverty is essentially powerlessness. Solving poverty and hunger means empowering the poor. Then he moves over and says, what are the policy implications of that? The redistribution of power is necessary between rich and poor nations, and between rich and poor within third world, or within any nation. I mean, he's talking about the third world problem here, but within nations. Now,
but the wealthy are not going to change the distribution of power. They are too egocentric to say that their idea of justice, I mean, if you're going to go with the definition of justice is to be in control of your own destiny, I don't think the wealthy are going to be much involved in justice.
Okay. When I look at different actions a little later on, I look at one, nations which have made that change and tried to shift the balance of power, and nations where they have not made that change, I look at work in those countries a little differently, and I'll elaborate on that a little bit later. But for example, when we work in Peru, we are constantly confronted with the fact that the power balance is not very even, and it limits a lot of the things that we can do. And if you're talking about, I don't know, I'm missing something here. You're speaking very clearly. It's not that. I'm just...
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
It seems to me that you can't really use the components separately. You have to take them in a whole. And one answer to, I think, your concern is that participation without solidarity is favoring. However things are set up. But the claim of solidarity, as you read it, was that you foster it for everyone. And some crucial part of the question of participation is who's included. If everyone is included, then the notion of participation and solidarity then would mean, just as you might expect, we the rich here could realize there's a claim on us to support those who are poor, and that there's nothing sufficient about about fostering merely our own well-being. So I think maybe part of the answer, at least, of what he's saying there is you can't take those apart as though by themselves they're definitions.
And maybe just to follow up too, Mary, are you saying that in a country where the power is balanced more equitably, it's fine to work with this? In a country where the power is very unequally distributed, this framework just isn't going to go very far.
Has there ever been in history a powerful people that gave up their power voluntarily?
And that is a major issue amongst anybody who works in development or with dependency theory and talks about liberation. Can you have a nonviolent transformation and redistribution of power? Can you do that through education, through small groups experimenting, trying things, and or does it have to be revolution?
Didn't that happen when Canada became independent of Great Britain in 1868? They just separated, and England accepted it. And hadn't that pretty much happened in India, where they gave up their power without the war, without revolution?
I don't. Somebody want to respond to that? Within a country, though, can you name a time when those in power willingly gave it up?
It's only been individuals that have ever done it, I think. In rare cases.
Even in El Salvador, they said some of the participants of the most democratic move that they had before they left government voluntarily redistributed their own land. They were all assassinated a little while later, but they did take steps in that direction. I mean, I think one of the problems that it raises is if you really start doing it, there's a lot of people who get scared and who think you then are part of the problem. If we all started radically redistributing our land, my guess is people who don't want to do that would be scared of that.
Yeah, I know in El Salvador, those people who saw that redistribution coming bought their own defense, their own small armies to protect them, which is part of the problem down there. Well, I'm going to move on, but how you bring about a redistribution of power, say, maybe that'd be a good forum during the evening. How do you redistribute power? How would it be done? What's possible? Well, here are a few examples. First of all, I think things that we can do here in the United States. Certainly we can, I think we need to support the new international economic order through our representatives. And we haven't been very successful so far, but you can work through representatives. I think we need to encourage the United States government agencies that support the poor. I don't know if any of you are aware, but in the mid-70s, there was something called the New Directions, where Congress told our Agency for International Development, AID, that they had to help the poorest 40%, either poorest nations or the poorest 40% in any country. That was a revolutionary change in the way in which we tried to carry out development assistance. It was very difficult to do, and in fact, so difficult for them to do because they were government to government that they are now working through private voluntary organizations, and they give a lot of money to those groups to do that kind of work. There are a number of groups who refuse to accept that money because they don't want any connection with government or being associated or affiliated or whatever with CIA, etc. But that's another possibility. Third, I think that we should not step in, as we often do, to stop revolutions by the masses who seem to be seeking more economic justice, especially in cases like Latin America. Fourth, I think we need to support the nations that have already made internal reforms. And we, as I mentioned the other day, we did not do that in Chile. We did not do that in Jamaica. We did not do a very good job in Peru, which was trying to make some changes. We have not been very supportive of Tanzania, but I think we need to support those countries. I know I'm very interested in the future of Tanzania, and would try to do whatever possible to make sure that the United States does not get in the way of that, I don't know if I should call it experiment, but of that development model. And then fifth, in nations where there is no internal reform, what do you do? And I don't know, Mary, I don't know if I'm still going to answer your question at all, but I'm going to try and explain some of the things that we've been doing in a country like Peru, where that internal reform has not taken place, and where you're always battling those who are very powerful. What kind of changes can you really make? So I want to say a little bit about my experiences in Peru. But first of all, let me just say something about the countries. There's a lot of organizations. Has anybody heard of the Interreligious Task Force? Well, they have a toll-free number. And you can find out what's going on, what the issues are that are before Congress. You can contact your representatives, and you can make it, it's possible to make a difference there. Bread for the World, Amnesty International. There are many ways in which you can become involved politically. Now to move back to supporting nations that are interested in self-reliant development. There are not very many around. But those that do or pursue self-reliant development have the following characteristics. First, they have one of their major goals is a direct attack on poverty. Instead of saying, we'll work with the rich and hopefully it trickles down, they say, in too many cases, you work with the rich and it seems like whatever is there for the poor even ends up trickling up to the rich. And so there's usually land reform, a redistribution of the means of production. There aren't a lot of countries who have done that, but there are some. If you read Tanzania and Nyeri, you'll find that one of their major objectives or goals is a direct attack on the worst forms of poverty, trying to make the living conditions more humane for their people, so that social services and health and education, housing, food, and clothing become very important. And they work within the concept of the Ujamaa village, and some would refer to it as African socialism, at least as it's known in Tanzania, or democratic socialism, Christian socialism. A second thing that you can look for is countries that build on their local resources and values. Nyeri, for example, says, we are going to build, our major resource is our people and the resources we have. And we may not have a lot of resources, but we're going to build on those. We're not going to just simply take money and let everything come in from the outside. We're going to build on what we have. And in the process, they stress appropriate development, the use of local resources that they have. And they look at their own culture and their values. They're not going to try and destroy this concept of Ujamaa, familyhood, just to develop like the West. They're going to try and dictate what their own development will look like. They use appropriate technologies that are right for their people and their place. The education is appropriate. I've worked now in three schools, Concordia, Wartburg, and Luther, where we've raised money on college campuses to build schools in Tanzania. And we've raised enough money now for five schools. All we supply is the few materials. I mean, to build a school for $2,300, I mean, you can imagine, most of the resources, they find themselves, they do their own work, it's just for a few transportation costs and a few items that they don't have. And then the education they have within those schools is very appropriate to their needs, to their country, and health. Third, maximize the participation of people. People are agents of their own change. They control their destiny. Because I teach development, if there's one thing that's just terribly important to me, and that is that development must come from within. Whether it's the individual or a country or whatever, if it does not come from within, it gets transplanted from outside or whatever, it's just really not development. And you're not going to get very many people. I mean, when someone else tries to develop you the way they want you to develop, you know, how successful are they? But if it's something that you're interested in and they nurture your growth and you're responsible for your own development, the results usually are, at least in your, as far as you're concerned, much more successful. You need to be involved in all phases of the development. planning, implementation, goal setting. And then lastly, they move to the term interdependence and collective self-reliance. Solidarity is very important. Working together, cooperatives. First, they often stress self-reliance at home, and then they move to the international arena. But when they move to the international arena, they want to move in such a way that the relationships are horizontal rather than vertical. Tanzania has turned down a lot of assistance from outside because they see themselves getting locked into something where the people on the outside will have too much domination over what's going on. They want to work as equals when they start trading. Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering, it seems to me that one of the main problems in the West, and particularly the United States, is we would be more received in our assistance in Tanzania if we would say maybe a two-way street. Could maybe some of the ideas and the successful traditional operations in Tanzania be looked at in the United States in, anywhere that might possibly be able to adapt some of their methods. And yeah. Generally, we're really resistant. We don't even want to listen to something like this. The fact that people in Tanzania could show us something, ways to live a little better, possibly.
Yeah, I really appreciate your bringing that up. One of the reasons why I'm so supportive of these school building projects is that we always have two objectives. One is raising funds. Second is educating people in the United States. One about Tanzania, but two, we want to learn something from Tanzania. And if you've ever had the chance to be in Tanzania and hear about it, you realize that they have a lot that they can teach us about life and what's important and how they relate to each other and just the spirit of Ujima, that spirit of familyhood. So we try to bring in people from Tanzania. We brought in a woman who's living in the Twin Cities who's an excellent dancer, and just through the dance, you learn so much about the country. And so, yeah, clearly a two-way street. Now, you know, the more I'm thinking about how limited it is, the world is in the number of nations that are doing something like this, the more I'm beginning to think maybe we really need a good session here on nonviolence as opposed to violence or revolutionary ways of bringing about change. Yes, Larry?
The theme session this Sunday morning is on singing the Lord's song, nonviolence.
Oh,
so that's
okay.
Partial response.
Good. All right, good. To find countries like that, Jamaica under Manley tried to do some things like this, but wasn't able to. I think Chile was moving in that direction. They were trying to define their own development, take over their own resources and develop them, give the people a little more participation, but did not last very long. Right? I mean, if there's one thing that probably has disturbed me more than anything else about the Reagan administration, it's that everything seems to be seen in an east-west direction. I mean, every issue is analyzed east-west. And I'm not going to say that that's not part of the issues. I mean, I don't understand all of the complexities. But it's always east-west. If it's El Salvador, it's never north-south. What are the problems of the poor in the South, and what is our role in it? It's east-west, Soviet Union, United States. Everything is east-west. And I think that's just terribly dangerous to see everything in that light, and basically only in that light. And so Latin America is probably the next area that's moving into this direction, with El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. Costa Rica's a little different than Panama, but I mean, there are nations moving in this direction. I mean, I said, we live in a revolutionary world. And how are we going to react? How are we going to be responsible as Christians in that revolutionary world? I think if we look at the problems east-west, we're going to have some problems. We need to listen. And when those things take place, let the poor, they know their problems, and let them, I mean, if we really believe in the radical message that Jesus had, that we need to be more open. I want to say a few things in the last few minutes about a program that I've worked with. I know how dangerous it is to be able to know that you've got a certain amount of time to do some talking, so you always end up talking about something that's closest to you or something that you're doing, and you may end up boring a lot of people. But I want to give this a try, because this program is a Lutheran World
Federation program. It's a development program, and I think the lessons that I have learned in that program and things that I have discussed with the director and the way the program is going excite me for many reasons. It has taught me so much about myself and so much about the United States that I think it's worth repeating some of these things. It's Lutheran World Federation out of Geneva, Switzerland. The program began because of an earthquake in Peru, one of the largest in the history of the world, I think the fourth or fifth largest one. 38 relief agencies came in as an act of mercy. The fellow from Switzerland, who just happened to be building the hydroelectric plant in Lima, was asked to direct the relief effort. And fell in love with the people over those 2 years and decided to try and do something in development. And the things that he has done, I think, are so good. First of all, the way the program works, I'm going to tie it in. What I'm saying is there are a lot of countries where the power is very unevenly distributed, but there are people suffering and hurting in those countries. Are there things that we can do as Christians in those countries? Yes, I think we can. And when you have money to try and help in acts of justice, what kind of ground rules do you set up? What is a good program? What isn't? And you don't want to just give money away to a program that's going to build sidewalks like a lot of people did. You know, they had this emergency, this disaster. The cement came in, and there's sidewalks in this one town. Street lights, people just don't need sidewalks at this stage. I mean, it had nothing to do with it. But the cement was there, and they built sidewalks. What are good programs? I want to just characterize a few things. First of all, my view of development, I'm in economic development. My view of development is I refuse to go beyond basic needs in helping anybody if I make a special effort to help them. Maybe through trade, that's a different thing. Trade between equals. But I don't care at all, personally, about anything above basic needs. It took me a long time to reach that level. But food, clothing, shelter, health, education, those things, I don't see how we as Christians can deny that of anybody. And I think that's part of this idea of sufficiency. If you have too much, as we discussed yesterday in the session on the living word encounter, you may have problems. But if you don't have enough, one thing we tend to do is say, the people in the poor countries, well, they're poor, they have low incomes, but they have family, and it's really not bad. And I know when I get into the mountains of Peru, it's just beautiful. A little bit like this around here, just that they're 22,000 feet at the height instead of 8,000. And it just looks beautiful. The people seem to relate well, and I go, on my bad days, I say, I'm going to retire, buy a plot in the Andes, and just go down there and live. But to think that, to glamorize poverty, is one of the worst things we can do. The agony of seeing people with children dying because there's just a simple medicine that they can't get access to, or shortages of food, or to watch people develop without good diets, and therefore not develop mentally and physically properly. That's just I don't know how anybody can say basic needs aren't important. By the way, the poor really know how to eat. That's one thing we send people down in the area of nutrition, teach them how to have good diets. Boy, they know how to mix foods to get the highest nutritional value. Their problem is they don't have steady supplies or incomes to buy those goods at times. Certainly you could add to it and give them a little more variety. But I mean, basic needs for me is terribly important. Well, the way we've worked, I'm going to move down to number three. In our projects, we are convinced that people have to be involved in every phase. With the exception of the first 12 projects, we have never, and I say we for this reason, I better tell you my role in it. I'm about 0.00001% of the program. But I do writing for them because the director is a practitioner. And if you know practitioners, try to get them to write something. His annual report is a 4-page report about a few stories of what happened last year. And when people donate money and give money to these issues, they get very nervous when people write little 4-page stories and that's all they ever hear about. So I, as a development economist and knowing about the program, I go down, and just on occasion, and write summaries. I'm going to tell you just another little aside. When you write that summary, it is so tough because One, the people who give the money want to see fast results. They want to see something. Development is a slow evolutionary process. You may be able to speed it up, but you cannot skip steps. And when you do, you just end up with problems. So, the people who give money want to see things. But that's not the major part of the program. So how do you convince people that something's happening when it's so much of it's intangible? Second, the people, the government there is very afraid of an outside threat or of people who are poor getting more power and shifts of power. So how do you try and tell the government that those shifts aren't taking place very fast and that they're not a threat? And then third, the people who work in the same kind of programs in Peru are very jealous because the programs are working quite well. And so they say, you're not moving fast enough, you're not political enough, you're not a big enough revolutionary. So you've got three sides. One wants more revolution, one says you're moving too fast, the other one just wants to see the results. And to write for those kinds of situations is really difficult. But what the program, the way the program works, the people initiate the request. It comes from a community, and it comes from the entire community. It's a cooperative thing. I'm going to move back to the culture too. When you go in and work in these areas, there's a danger. I came in there thinking that I was a big, generous Norwegian, real big heart, just a nice person. Can't stand conflict. Just don't want to get mad at anybody. And one of my first encounters in the mountains, we'd walked 10 miles back into a village, and all of a sudden this fellow came from another village. He'd literally run for about 8 hours to get there because he'd heard that we were there. He stands outside for a half hour before the director lets him come in because he was talking to me and some other people. He's just shaking. He's scared. He walks in, and these are the Quechua Indians, or the old Inca Indians, speak Quechua. And he comes in and he asks for something. He says, my village wants something. And the director proceeds to just chew him out for not doing several things that are expected of him. And the guy's just crushed. And so he goes out and he says, go out and get those things done, come back. And when he left, I said to him, how can you, a Christian, do anything like that to a human being? He said, the first 2 years, he said, I tried to be the nice person, the goody-goody whatever. And he said, if you don't understand the culture and the people, they lived under the Incas, the Spaniards, and now the current government. And he said, you come in like you're bearing gifts and you're someone who's nice, you will go nowhere because they only know that if there are gifts, you want something later on in return. And you'll just come back and take it. But he said, you treat them like that. He said, I hope it changes. I mean, he's all for change. But he says, you treat them like that. That tells them that you really care about them. Gee, he's asked me to come back and work for a year with him. And I said, I don't know if I could ever get to that point where I could just chew people out up and down because I really care about them. They make the request. And then with the consultation, the group goes over that request. And it turns out that they want usually three things. They either want a school building, they want an irrigation system, or they want drinking water. Those just seem to be the three big needs in that area. Now, through those three things, we call those infrastructure, schools and irrigation and drinking water, we meet a lot of basic needs. Education, food with irrigation, and drinking water help. And in the process, part of the package is that many other things come with it that are appropriate to the area. Appropriate technologies are always used. You'd love to see the irrigation systems. I'll bet you 60% of it gets lost as it trickles down through the rocks. But 40% of it gets there. And that's 40% that was never getting there before. And there's things that they can do. They also plan on how the project will be implemented. Now, as outsiders, we might want to come in and say, well, you should do this and that. We know how to organize. The fellow refuses to be involved in that in any way or any form because you don't understand the local people. I mean, they have to be involved. They know their values. They know how they relate to each other. That's their problem. And if you get involved in the squabbles within the village, you won't go very far. And so people all sign agreements saying how much they'll work. And then when they're done, if they haven't done the work, he throws them in jail. And he's only had to do it 4 times. And once again, it was a sign that he cared. He cared so much that he'd do that. Now, that wasn't the way I thought. But this is part of local culture. They use their own resources as much as possible. And he does not believe in gifts. He will give them assistance, some things they don't have. And he'll make them pay something like 25% more than they think they can pay. Certainly he subsidizes things. But they have to pay. And in that process, there is an awful lot of dignity that's created. And I should say, what's happening in this whole process, and they work together in communities, because when you're poor, it's very difficult to work alone. It's much easier to work in a group. You have more support in a larger group and a little more power. But what people see and take pictures of is schoolhouses, irrigation, and drinking water projects. But what's really happening is that he is laying a base. By the way, he has 30 Peruvians that work with him. He's the only outsider. So it's local resources. He lays the base of helping them organize a little bit. There's a little bit of little change in attitude. And by attitude, I mean they think that they're no better than dirt. And that's a terrible thing. But to this dignity and self-worth, I don't think we just appreciate how serious it is when it's not present. But all their lives, they've been told, either by the Catholic Church, or by the government, or by the money lenders around there, that they're just no good. And they really believe it. And to see a person that broken really hurts.
Did they make progress
under that system, or this new one?
No, this new one.
Well, I'll say just a little bit about it. It's a very slow process. But what you try to do is change some attitudes, get some organization, and a little education, a little understanding. But the number one objective of his projects, and that's why I like these projects so much, is to instill or to create in these people confidence and self-worth. He says that's the only thing I'm really interested in. And what I'm doing by working with these projects is I'm meeting some basic needs. You can take the pictures. But what I really want to do is give them some sense of power. And so he's changing the power relationships. And when the groups in the village who have the power don't respond or don't work for the well-being of the whole community, he says, forget it. I'll go to another community. And then they see the other community do it, and they go, gee, now we don't have that. And changes take place. And if they don't, they get new leadership. It's a tricky thing to work with. But power relationships change somewhat. The problem is these are small scale. But nonetheless, it's a place where you can do some work. And when you do that, you're really bringing about human development. That's what I like so much about it. It's the dignity, that self-worth. Now, he's been there about 10 years. And there are villages now who completely bypass Lutheran World Federation. If they have a need, they get 3, 4, 5 villages together who have had a project and sort of know how to do things now. And they'll go to the government. They'll go to wherever they have to go to try and get some support for their projects. Now, that hasn't happened a lot. But it is starting to happen. I don't think you can do any development in less than 10 years. And that's just a personal view. I don't think you can hardly see any significant changes within 10 years. Well, you can take the pictures of the buildings, but I mean human development. And another thing that's happened is he's reversed the trend in certain areas of a migration from the rural area to the city. In some of the places, they're coming from the city and moving back to the rural areas. Well, I have now that it's about 1:45. I don't know if I could summarize quickly. I mean, it's tough working in these areas. And I like projects that really try and promote this, what I call a sense of justice. I like the nations that are working at that. And I would like to be very supportive of them. But it is not an easy area to work in. It is frustrating. Power, the development is redistributing power and resources. It's a tricky, tricky thing to do. Yeah, okay.
How about the government of Peru? Are they supportive of the development programs?
So far, they've been very supportive because it was a military government. And they did want to bring their people into the mainstream. That's one reason why Peru was probably a little more open than some might be. But there isn't any doubt they're still a little leery of what's going on, not really sure what's happening. But for the most part, they haven't created any big problems. I mean, he's been thrown in jail a couple times, but that was for not having a passport with or something. Never for
pretty different than like the situation in El Salvador or Guatemala then, because it seems like, you know, they've tried to do things where they've organized more, tried to form cooperatives or groups or whatever. And anytime anyone with education or you know, tends to do things like that in the way of development, it seems like they're shot or gotten rid of or whatever. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but that's the picture I get. One of the Catholic churches,
yeah, I don't know if I should bring this up, but somebody brought it up in another session. I think that's why what's written on the bus is really very true. The ride up is free, is that right?
Yeah.
But the ride down, I mean, once you start learning things and you want to take on a responsible role, there's a lot of uncertainty about what will happen. I mean, it is just a radical way of looking at things. Yes, Larry?
Your remark, Mark, that you don't think development happens short of 10-year commitment calls into serious question most government programs.
Oh, absolutely.
In Tanzania, it was sad to see very competent and well-meaning Americans, many of whom were Peace Corps volunteers, enjoyed their time abroad, found it personally enriching, wanted deeply to help local development, but were on 3-year contracts and no more than got started with something and then left it and somebody else came. And the Tanzanians just had, you know, nothing was gained there, right? You've got to make a commitment 10, 15, 20 years. But I don't know any government program in development that ever operates on terms of long-term contracts like that. And it just was not helpful in development. The projects sitting around Tanzania that are in shambles, not because of insensitive folks, but just the structure of being with the people, just starting to learn the language, just getting to know them culturally, and then going home. Those projects sit everywhere.
Yeah. No, I like to always have a chance to visit with people going into the Peace Corps, to let them know what it is that they're getting into. I'm not against the Peace Corps itself. I think there are some good things that come out of it, but you have to know the limitations. That's one of the reasons why when I finished my graduate work, I had a couple opportunities to work with AID, Agency for International Development, and I just couldn't do it because of the nature of the programs. And that's why what Lutheran World Federation is doing just excites me so much. I just love being involved with the program. And then he has 30 people who are working who are Peruvians. Oh, he's got a couple of right-hand individuals who really are beginning to get a feel for some of these things. And by the way, anybody who works in development should have as the ultimate goal getting out of there. I mean, if you're really successful, after 20 years, you can leave. And that's another reason why I know our family, we had to make some tough decisions about 5 years ago. And we did decide that if we were going to make a commitment to a third world setting, that it would be at least 10 years probably. We were willing to think about 5, but really we thought it would be 10 years. And so at the time we didn't feel we could do that. But I should emphasize again, we are the rich. We are in the north. And there are times, there are programs, there are countries that we can look at and support. But much of the work's going to have to be done in the south by the people in the south. And I think we just have to make sure we understand the problems and we don't get in their way.
Yeah, I think that's really the key, is we got to understand the problems. And I'm not very convinced that that's happening hard at all. It sounds to me like what you're talking about here in a situation in Peru is a case where some of the problems at least are being understood. But it just seems that we've always been very arrogant, and it's really hard for even people in the third world that are educated not to be arrogant.
And that's why tomorrow I want to talk about justice begins at home, and then you begin to understand some of those things here, then you can make the extension. And until we do that, I can talk about this all day long. We won't really feel it very much. And did you want to make one last comment?
Well, it's just a plea. Well, no, there's not one.